This is Ben Goujon with Quad City Arts, and welcome back to Talking Art, supported by Quad City Bank and Trust. Today, I am talking art with pianist, composer, arranger, producer, educator, Yamaha artist, and multi-Grammy nominee and the 2010 Grammy winner, Lawrence Hobgood, who will be performing with his trio on Sunday, December 1st at Sound Conservatory. Lawrence, welcome back to the Quad Cities and welcome back to Talking Art.
Thank you, Ben. It's great to be back.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here. I know you did an interview with Carolyn a while back, but we're excited to have you back in town and back on the show. You're going to be performing on December 1st at Sound Conservatory, correct?
I believe that that is correct.
Well, all the info tells us that it is. We're so excited to have you back. You're such an accomplished musician, and getting someone of your caliber here in the Quad Cities to perform is really exciting. Tell us a little bit about the concert and what you're going to be playing.
Well, we're really going to be focused on Christmas music. I have something of an unusual relationship with Christmas music for musicians, and particularly jazz musicians. And in a word or a couple of words, that relationship is that I love it.
I do too. So we can talk Christmas music all day.
this actually happens almost every year. That it takes different forms, but somebody will sort of apologetically ask for Christmas music, or one of the ones I'm doing a private concert on the West Coast about a week after this one, where they've specifically requested that I play no Christmas music. there can be quite a gamut of attitudes about Christmas music, but musicians tend to not like it that much for a variety of reasons.
Sure.
But to just jump to the positive, we had a very, very strong Christmas tradition in my family, and maybe worth saying that we do have a heavy sort of United Kingdom background.
Sure.
Coming from the Christian culture.
Yeah.
On both sides of my family. So as a result, Christmas is very meaningful for me, and both my parents were in the arts. So Christmas music was extremely prevalent in our home. And so I just love it. And there's nothing like getting together with a bass player and drummer in a trio format and just playing some great Christmas music, and then doing the jazz thing too, and stretching out on it and doing some improvising. And the melodies and the feelings are so evocative of the season, and I just love doing it. So that'll be the focus. We'll probably throw in a couple of non-Christmas things,
sure,
original pieces arrangements of things that I've done just for the fun of it, you know, just to vary it up a little bit. But Christmas is the theme.
That's awesome. And we are so excited to have you here. You've put out a Christmas album, and it's, I know before it was a big success. So we're excited to have you back. All right, let's chat a little more. I love that you love Christmas music, because I love Christmas music too. I also grew up in a very Catholic background, and one of our big family traditions was on Christmas Eve, we all got out the songbooks and sang Christmas carols for an hour or two. And there's something about it, like you said, it evokes the season, it evokes the feeling. You put out a Christmas album, correct?
I did.
Yeah, and what I love about what you did with that album is, you know, you I would imagine some of the things that you said, like musicians don't like, are is the fact that Christmas music probably gets a little formulaic and jukeboxy.
Yeah.
But you stretch and expand those songs and make them into such journeys. Tell me about that and about that process.
Well, I guess, you know, I can get away with making the following comment as long as I don't criticize anybody in particular, but a lot of the highly commercial newly generated versions of classic Christmas musical fare strike me. The main thing that I feel is that they're just insincere.
Sure.
You know, slickly produced stuff where, you know, and listen, I'm all for exploration and expanding tradition when it's appropriate. Okay. But there are certain times where, whether it's Bing Crosby or Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald or Sinatra or Perry Como or whoever, it's just like, don't, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. The classic versions are just so, so perfect. And
whenever I hear like a cover of like one of Andy Williams' songs, I'm like, it's not that. Like, he did those so well. You're not adding anything new to the conversation, and your interpretations do add something to the conversation, which I really appreciated as a listener.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I don't know whether people find technical detail to be interesting, but in this case, I do believe that it's sort of germane to the conversation, which is that on the record. I think there's only the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy. I think we had to use click track because I was, it's not the only track on the record where I was overdubbing some second, like electric piano.
Sure.
But on the other ones, I didn't need to use click track. So I don't know. I never know how much people know about click track or what it is. For those that don't know, it's when you're recording in the studio, you wear headphones, and one of the things that the engineer can do is he can put what is essentially a metronome. Most people know what that is. It's a little clicking sound that keeps the time steady.
Yeah.
And it's used in almost all the commercial music that you hear. It's used.
Sure.
And it's a sort of a don't get me started thing because going beyond the Christmas question, the broad use of it has, amongst other things, led to now this is going to sound cynical, but it's not that far off base, a whole generation of musicians that no longer have learned the science of keeping time on their own because they got a machine that does it for them. So anyway, one of the reasons to me that the Christmas record I made is so I'm proud of the way that it breathes.
Yeah.
And the way that the space is not wooden, you know, it's not rigid. And if there are any ways to describe what it is that I love about especially great choral Christmas music, it's just, it's got that sort of fat feeling. I mean that in a very good sense. We talk about the rhythm and the beat, in jazz, and we talk about the beat is fat. The beat is wide, you know, you don't want it to, you just don't want things to feel too sort of, ultra regulated, you know?
Well, sure. It's almost like an auto tune.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. Same department of you know, Pandora's box sort of technology.
Yeah. Well, and that's such a big conversation now with the advent of AI, and that's coming out and all the discussions around AI and art is, you know, if for me the beauty of art, whether it be music or theater, is some of the imperfection in it. And
absolutely. One of my favorite words for describing it is, you know, flawed. The most people would consider if I said flawed perfection, they would consider that oxymoronic. I do not.
Yeah.
I feel like there has to be some flaw to it because that's humanity. And also worth noting, it's our music system. The music system itself, not to get into a theory lesson that nobody's going to understand, but take my word for it. We have a pitch system where we have 12 pitches in the chromatic scale, and 12 is a symmetrical number.
Right.
A lot of math people will tell you that 12 is a more interesting number than 10 because it's integrally divisible into 3 as well as 2.
Sure.
Whereas 10 is not. Mm-hmm. And so we have this perfectly symmetrical system of pitches. And what do? We come along and the entire system of defining harmony and melody that is epitomized by the 7 church mode scales that were created in order for Gregorian chant and all the music that followed to happen. They're the scales that we still base everything on. And one of them is the much beloved major scale that is sort of the reference point for everybody. Those are all asymmetrical scales.
Sure.
So I've always thought that that's a really deep reflection of just the nature of humanity. We're not perfect, you know, and we tend to shy away from things that are too perfect in all the instances that really matter. So anyway, end of music theory lecture.
Well, I think about it though, like a color scale, like, you know, you have these colors that are primary and our tertiary and our secondary colors, but there are an infinite amount of gradients in between. And, you know, we've created this music scale of, you know, like you said, the 12 notes, and like there are sounds between those notes that a piano or
I like your reference to color scale. I teach arranging and composing at the New School here. Mm-hmm. And when I'm trying to get my students to find a deeper understanding of how harmony works, one of my favorite analogies is to say, imagine Leonardo da Vinci is painting the Mona Lisa. And he's standing there in his studio and he has his palette with the paint on it. Mm-hmm. Now imagine Leonardo's palette, all right? Do you think that like a child's, you know, little tin box of watercolors, do you think that if you look at Leonardo's palette, you've got, okay, here's yellow, here's red, here's blue, here's green, they're all separate. No, of course not. If you look at Leonardo's palette, frankly, to the casual glance, it probably looks like a big mess.
Yeah.
Right? But then if you look closer, you probably will say, oh, well, you know, there is this one area over here that seems sort of green-centric. And I do notice that the sort of the brighter colors do seem to be in sort of a mishmash over here on another part of the palette. But overall, it still is a kind of mishmash is not a bad way to describe it. And yet, of course, Leonardo knows exactly what he's doing and knows exactly where his color combinations are. And harmony is very much like that. So back to the analogy of just it's not perfect. It's not ultra regular. Or symmetrical. It's kind of a mess, and so are we. So are we humans. And you know, I mean, what better time of year to recognize that and to, you know, humble ourselves before our cultures and our traditions that are sacred to us. and you know, give of our spirit to something that's bigger than we are.
Yeah.
To me, that's what Christmas is about.
Yeah, that's a really beautiful sentiment about that. You know, just our imperfection as man. you know, exemplified through our music and through our art and through our culture and how we portray ourselves. Tell me more, Lawrence, a little bit just about how you got into jazz. I mean, you've had such a wonderful career. But how did that start? What inspired your love for jazz?
Well, so I'll tell you two things. It's obviously a extensive question, but, the main general thing is that I started classical piano study in first grade, but I had been playing before that.
Okay.
Just messing around, and that's why they said we better get this kid lessons because this seems to be what he wants to do.
Did you have a musical family?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Although not professionally. My dad was a very famous theater teacher. He founded the still very respected theater program at Southern Methodist University in Dallas.
Oh, yeah. That's a great program.
And then the way that we wound up in Champaign-Urbana is that the University of Illinois beckoned him away from SMU because they wanted to build a similar program in their theater school there. And that's also a very highly regarded program. Mm-hmm. Based largely on the modifications that he made when we moved there in 1975. But he had been a classical violinist when he was young. And he still sometimes would pull the violin out and play just as a little hobby. Meanwhile, my mom was an Appalachian folk artist, and that included singing and playing auto harp and a little dulcimer. So music in our house was constant.
Sure.
Absolutely constant. And just to say, I never had any discouragement, the stereotypical line is the father saying to the child, you know, well, I love music too, but, you know, you have to pay the rent in life and whatever. I never heard any of that.
Sure.
I never had anything besides encouragement. I was going to tell you two things. The one of them, which is general, is that I always wanted to improvise before I knew exactly what that meant. As you can imagine, that caused some frustration with my classical teacher. Because you're not supposed to mess around with Bach and Beethoven and Mozart. And I would innocently sort of try injecting my own little ideas into what they had done. And it wasn't until we moved to Illinois, and up to that point, I had taken music pretty seriously. But when we moved, I was 15.
Mm-hmm.
It's an awkward time to change places where you live. It's an awkward social time. And my dad noticed that I wasn't really playing. And I think he finally had to acknowledge to himself that his conviction that I had, strong enough musical talent to consider it as my career or my life's work, maybe that wasn't in a purely classical direction.
Sure.
And so maybe we better get this kid some jazz lessons. And that's what happened. And then it sort of took off from there. But backing up, my dad, took me to see when Duke Ellington retired, quote unquote, from what had been one of the more hectic touring schedules that any musician ever tried to maintain. But of course that doesn't mean he wasn't going to keep making music. And what happened after his official announcement of retirement were what were called the sacred concerts. And the most famous piece to come from that that people might know is the piece Come Sunday, was from that repertoire.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was 11 years old, and my dad said that Duke Ellington is performing at this was a huge new Methodist church in North Dallas, and that he was going to take me to this concert. It was expanded big band. I remember one thing I really was fascinated by was the bass saxophone. There is a saxophone that's even bigger and deeper, lower register than a baritone saxophone.
I didn't know.
Normally, that. Yeah, and it's in fact it's so big the player can't lift it. It's on a little trolley.
Oh wow!
So it was an expanded big band bass saxophone. I think there was a couple of French horns. Mm-hmm. I don't think there were strings. It was still big band instrumentation with just a few added items. And then about a 30 voice gospel choir with maybe four or five vocal soloists in front. It just blew me away. I was 11 years old.
Yeah. You know?
And I had enjoyed listening to Duke Ellington's music on my parents' stereo system.
Sure.
But we played all kinds of music in the house. For one thing, my dad's older brother was a very famous country western agent. And so we listened to country music, we listened to classical music, we listened to jazz music. It was all in there. At this Duke Ellington concert, my father had suggested that we bring along our copy of Duke Ellington's Greatest Hits. And after the concert, I stood online and got Duke's autograph. And as he was giving it to me, I know this sounds so trite as to be almost not credible, but I stand by it because I remember it. I stood there in my little blue suit and I looked up at him and I said, "Mr. Ellington, I'm a piano player and someday I'm going to be a jazz piano player just like you." And if you remember from a lot of Duke's live recordings, he had this sort of chortle laugh that mm-hmm. you would hear sometimes. It was very much, rah, 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 you know, sort of like that. You could hear him doing that. And that's this. When I said that, he was standing there. I'll never forget it. He was wearing a fuchsia tuxedo with the big, you know, ripple shirt and
sure.
And, you know, had his entourage standing around him. And I said that and he just cracked up and signed my record. And that's now framed and hanging here in my studio.
Oh, that's so awesome. That's so great. I love what you were talking earlier about improvisation. And one thing that I really love about your work is I was listening to Tessa Terra yesterday.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you play all these, you know, kind of, I would call most of them standards, you know, maybe not in a traditionalist sense, but they're songs that we all know. And
right.
There were just elements where I would feel like we went in almost into a different genre than either your jazz or the classic, but just all these little genres and things that you're pulling from that, you know, listening to you talk about what you listened to growing up and those different musical influences that you were around and exposed to, like you mm-hmm. could just hear all of those coming in. And it was really wonderful and exciting to listen to and just hear all those little pops of different things. Like is that mm-hmm. kind of what you try to do when you're, you know, composing jazz or, you know, doing different arrangements of things?
I think the answer to your question is yes, except that as my wife would tell you, that it's not a question of trying. I can't help myself. So here's the way that I look at it. This is as close as I'll come to sticking my toe into any sort of political subjects. We like compartmentalization in this country.
Sure.
Our culture is all about making sure that everybody knows that this is defined this way and that's defined that way. And I personally find most of that to be an illusion. Mm-hmm. And with respect to different types of music, to me, all these different genres and styles of music have so much more in common with each other than what separates them. And my favorite analogy for that is, as I've already mentioned in our conversation here, I grew up in Dallas, and it just so happened that when we left Dallas in 1975 to move to Illinois, nothing took me back there for many, many, many years.
Yeah.
During those intervening years, believe it or not, at one point I dated a woman that the whole basis for our connecting was that she went to the high school in Dallas that I would have gone to had we stayed there. All right.
Oh, that's funny.
So yeah, that was really funny. The point is that finally, it came up that a event got booked in Dallas and I was going to be going back to Dallas. Mm-hmm. And there was a day off there. So of course I planned to, you know, get out and go see the old neighborhood and stuff like that. So as I talked to people when the date was approaching, people that were familiar with Dallas, and I talked to several people who were, they were all like, oh, well, you know, it's changed so much. You haven't been there since 1975. Oh, you won't believe it. I mean, the city's just grown so much. It's a completely different place. And you know what? I got there and son of a gun, all the streets were where they used to be. You know, it turned out they had not plowed up the entire city and relayed the city map. After all, everything was, you know, I had no trouble finding my old school, my old house, our mm-hmm. old church, because they were all still right there where they used to be. And that's kind of that you see the analogy. That's my favorite analogy for this musical point, which is that the things that make things different from each other tend to be, and I'm using the word in a very literal sense, any kind of emotional judgment of anything, but they're superficial. They're surface things are what differentiate things from each other. The core, the core content of music, rhythm, harmony, melody, texture, timbre, intonation, all these different things that combine in the soup of whatever anything is, they're present in all the different kinds of music, and the things that separate them are really sort of incidental. So that's my approach to music, and the music that I end up making, especially whether it's original composition or if it's the sort of the highly reimagined work that you find on Tessitura, it's informed by all of those different things. I just don't see the lines between things like other people do, I guess.
Sure. And I was actually really curious about that, about how you approach original composition versus arranging something that's existing. Like as an artist and a musician, do you approach those differently, or do you kind of tend to look at it the same way?
Yes and no. Since you brought that up, there is one thing I'd like to take this opportunity to clarify. And this is a point that I make the first week of the semester in my class.
Sure.
The word arranging is really misunderstood.
Yeah.
In the sense that arranging as a term in music is associated with treatments of previously existing work. Whereas if somebody's written a brand new, whether you would call it a song, a brand new composition, whatever, then that's the word that's associated with it is composition, because mm-hmm. it's new. The truth of the matter is everything gets arranged.
Sure.
Brand new work. And doing a reworking of some piece that's over 100 years old. It all gets arranged. And what I mean by that is, you know, your, as I say to my class, your typical new song is written by a songwriter, these days very frequently a singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. And chances are, when they wrote that song, the core element that they had at the point where they would have said, okay, this is a song, I've finished writing it now, would they'd have a melody, an accompanying set of harmonies or chord progression, an implicit groove, which would not just include the tempo, but just sort of the stylistic nature of the rhythmic approach to the song. But that's just one person with a guitar or a piano playing the raw version of this new thing that they've created. And if a band is going to play it, then some decision has to get
arranged.
Just first things first, how are we going to start? As I say to my class, if you think about live, recorded, doesn't matter, mm-hmm. performances of music, how often is the very first note of the main melody the very first thing that you hear? And right. the answer is almost never, mm-hmm. almost never. There's always some sort of introduction. It might even be very, very brief, but there's something that happens that kind of gets us going before that main melody comes in. And this, again, is true in all, if you think about it, all different styles, all music, almost all the music that you listen to has some sort of introduction. Well, that's arranging. That's what it is.
Yeah.
So now to get back to your question, the biggest difference between arranging or reimagining something and doing and coming up with an original composition, this is a phenomenon that's been with me my whole life, and I don't mind sharing it. It's not that big of a deal, but so I don't have perfect pitch, mm-hmm. but I've always had laser relative pitch. Mm-hmm. And for those who don't know what that means, relative pitch means that if I hear one note, or really a better word is tone, if I hear a tone and then I know through somebody telling me or through me playing it on the piano. So I know if I know that that's an A, I can then triangulate and hear other notes as they relate to that and know pretty unerringly what they are.
Sure.
Okay. But I don't have perfect pitch. The reason I'm telling you that is because what happens when I write an original piece is that usually I just hear something in my head and I hear it very, very strong, sort of like I guess a nice analogy for some people would be the difference between an extraordinarily vivid dream that they feel like they remember, you know, just verbatim exactly what happened, as opposed to most yeah. dreams are sort of more elusive to remember specifics. Mm-hmm. And one of this phenomenon is that I'll hear something really strong and I'll be hearing it in a certain key. My brain will say, this is in A flat major. And yeah. I'll go to a piano and I'll be right.
Sure.
So the person that doesn't have perfect pitch, I'll hear an idea so strong and I'll just know that it's in this certain key. And it'll turn out that I'm right. And that's how I know that I'm on to something.
Right. I love that idea of just it being kind of like catching a dream on that.
Yeah.
I was also really curious about, I loved the poem jazz albums with Robert Pinsky you did.
Ah, yeah. We just, you know, we did a new one last year.
Was that the three? Poem Jazz 3?
Poem Jazz 3.
Yeah.
Proverbs of Limbo is the title.
Yeah, they're wonderful. And I wonder how, what was that process like of working with, You know, were you guys writing music and poems together, or was Robert coming in? And for those who don't know, Robert Pinsky was a 3-time poet laureate of the country. But was he taking existing work and you were composing to those? And how do you
this is very interesting. First of all, just to say it, Robert and I met about 2 weeks before we found ourselves in the studio together recording.
Oh, that's awesome.
our mutual friend, Richard Conley, who's a publisher, introduced us.
Mm-hmm.
But the most interesting thing I'll tell you is that I totally knew who Robert was, and mm-hmm. the idea that I was going to be collaborating one-on-one with Robert Pinsky just freaked me out. So I got deep with his poetry during that 2 weeks. I was like, I mean, I had read some Pinsky poetry before that, but now I need to go to school, you know?
Yeah.
So I got really deep into it, and the analytical part of me, as one probably couldn't help doing, made sort of a conscious issue of trying to interpret the meaning of his poems. And so we got into the studio and started recording, and we discussed some things and everything like that. But my feelings about what the meaning of the poems was, those feelings were guiding what I was playing. And in some cases that was okay. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I wasn't on the right track. And basically what happened was that at one point, we took a little break and we were having a cup of coffee and talking about what we were doing. And Robert suggested that I need to think more about just listening to the sound of his voice as he read or as he spoke. He mostly was not reading because he has his poems memorized.
Mm-hmm.
And when he does his spoken word work, when we're doing this, he's really riffing on his own poetry.
Sure.
He'll repeat lines. He'll come back to certain lines. It's very improvisational.
Oh, that's fun.
And what he basically said is like, you know, I think it's great that you've dug into my poems and you've thought about what they represent or what the concepts are. But now that we're in the studio and we're doing this, approach it more like just actual music and just listen to the sound. And that's what ended up making all the difference. But I will say, as a sort of an epilogue to that, as he himself observed when we had the finished product and then continued to work together, that the homework that I had done, if you want to call it that,
yeah,
I may have sort of pushed it to the unconscious level, but that was way different from not having done it at all.
Yeah, I totally relate to that. Like, as an actor, like, you do all this homework for a role and then you just try to forget it in performance, but it's there as the foundation for what you're bringing.
And it's there. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And, you know, we were talking earlier about some things that are related to music theory, and that's exactly the same there too.
Mm-hmm.
The whole reason that you study the music system and its history and traditions and where things came from and how they evolved is exactly like what we're saying. So then if I get together, for instance, as I'll be doing there in Moline, get together with a bass player and a drummer, I don't want to think about that stuff. I'm not sitting there playing on some song and going, okay, right now for this 2 bars, it's a major chord. And I think I'm going to choose the sharp 11 and the 13 to focus on, blah, blah. You know, I'm not going to think about that stuff at all, but it's all in the foundation. And in fact, to to briefly show my cynical side. This is an ongoing battle to convince the students in my class that they need to dig into theory more. It's not exactly a secret, but a lot of people may not know this, but music theory is sort of the bugaboo in music study.
Sure.
For a lot of people who make music, I'd like to think ultimately for everybody that makes music, any really meaningful music is going to draw on emotion. Mm-hmm. And the more beguiling aspects of what we call expression. And those things are all very innate, very intuitive. And the problem is a lot of people try to base their musical statements on nothing but intuitive actions and behavior. And which is a fancy way of saying that they're satisfied to just sort of coast on that and not really know that much about what they're doing. You know,
right.
If it sounds good, it's good. And it's an incredibly complex subject because at the end of the day, that is essentially true. Mm-hmm. And music that doesn't have feeling, music that does not move you, is music that people tend to not want to listen to.
Right.
But if you dig into the cracks of the actual profession of music, you'll find that a lot of people, not surprisingly, are looking for excuses to not dig deeper into something that is less comfortable for them than the things that are completely intuitively natural. And, you know, it's easy for them to convince themselves, well, I don't really want to get into that. It's not my strong suit anyway, or there's a lot of different ways to say it, but I try to get them to sort of challenge themselves a little bit more than just being happy with dwelling in their comfort zone and not venturing outside of that.
Yeah. And that makes me think of one thing my mentor in grad school always talked about was you're going to have that inspired performance or idea 1% of the time, but the other 99% is where your technique and your knowledge and just your study of the things like theory and all of that are going to support you for all those other times where you're not inspired to make the brilliant choice or whatever, you know?
Yeah. And that's a very good point. And it reminds me of, one of the more interesting ways of looking at this. I was privileged to be doing a clinic. I was just on the piano and keeping my mouth shut, with the great vibes player, Gary Burton. And he made this really fascinating statement, in the middle of this clinic, workshop, where he said, during the course of most improvised solos, there'll be one idea or phrase that is particularly beguiling or hooky or whatever you want to say, the
sure.
kind of thing that just really stands out. But if everything that you've played leading up to that inspired moment is just dross, you know,
mm-hmm.
is just sort of without a lot of shape or substance, then your inspired idea goes unappreciated because you've already lost the listener's ear at the time when it happens.
Yeah.
So I always remember that he said that. I'm like, man, that is so interesting because it is true. Even with, novice level players, there'll be some little moment, two or three notes or chords or whatever, that they'll do something. And it'll be like, wow, okay, check that out. But everything that came before may have been wanting for more direction or shape or lucidity or however you want to say it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that moment goes unappreciated. And so the idea is to craft something that has a coherence to it. And then to me, that gets us back to what we were talking about, that these are things that are universal in all forms of music. It's really only certain specifics and things like the overall degree of complexity. For instance, I now have some very close friends in the Nashville scene who mm-hmm. are country artists.
Sure.
And what they do is amazing. And they have a much larger audience than jazz does, and certainly than I do.
Mm-hmm.
And even they're willing to acknowledge that the music that they play is just inherently simpler. It's rhythmically simpler. It's harmonically simpler. It's melodically simpler. And that's one of the reasons it has such a huge audience, is because it's not as complex.
Right.
And yet all the things we were just saying are still true in terms of ultimately defining what really represents something that is meaningful. The juggling of the different elements, coherence. Yeah.
Well, I cannot wait to see you put all of these thoughts together at your concert at Sound Conservatory. We're so excited to have you back in the Quad Cities and playing for us again. We're going to thank Quad City Bank and Trust again for supporting Talking Art. And for more information on Lawrence, you can visit his website, www.lawrencehobgood.com. And for tickets to his concert on December 1st, go to the Sound Conservatory website, www.soundconservatory.com, and click on Concert Series. Once again, thank you so much, Lawrence, for joining us here today on Talking Art, and can't wait to see the show.
Thank you, Ben. I sure appreciate it. And I just want to say, my relationship with and experiences playing in Quad Cities has been and remains like really special to me. We first came there in the early 2000s for an educational residency with Quad City Arts. And it's really special. The priority and the mission of Quad City Arts and the attitudes and the support and all that kind of stuff. So it always means a lot to me to come back there. I always look forward to it.
Well, thank you so much. We love doing what we do. And I did not know you had come in with our visiting artist series. So that's amazing. Thank you so much, Lawrence. And we'll see you on December 1st.
Great, Ben. Thank you.
Have a good one.